80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. This is episode one of our podcast, episode one of a lot that are going to be coming out your way. This is a day that is 6 years in the making for our team and for myself. We're very happy to have you aboard the project and have you following along on our journey. I'm going to talk a little bit about the podcast and what you can expect in the next year and a half to 2 years of recording the podcast and actually releasing all these episodes to you guys out there. The way the podcast is going to work essentially is it's going to be a bi-weekly release. So for iTunes subscribers, for Google Play subscribers, and all those different applications, you're going to be receiving the podcast on every other Friday. We're going to be releasing it. Now, if you're a subscriber to our website at chasingearhart.com, you're also going to be receiving that a day early as a bonus. So you might want to head over to the website, sign up for it, and become a subscriber because you do get a lot of perks, and that's one of them. Now, the podcast that we're going to be hosting and talking about and releasing over the course of the next year and a half or 2 years is going to be featuring multiple guests from all across different realms in the Earhart community. We're going to be talking with everybody and giving everybody an equal platform to talk about their data and their analysis and their work. We're going to be speaking with people globally. So most people that are going to be contacting the podcast are going to be Skyping in from different parts of the world. We have participation from almost every country in the world for the most part. And we're going to be talking with them, asking them questions that are very straightforward so that way the audience can really get a grip on their research and their knowledge. And if they choose to do so, they can go ahead and continue online and research further. So our guest today for our inaugural podcast is a gentleman by the name of Tom King. He is an archaeologist. He is the senior archaeologist on the Tiger team, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. He's been a part of that team for quite some time now. And we're going to be discussing with Tom a little bit about himself, his background, his education, his professional background. And we're going to be getting right into the Tiger hypothesis in detail. We're going to be asking him about his opinions and his thoughts on the work that Tiger's done on the island of Nikumaroro for the last 28 years. He's actually going to be going out to Nikumaroro again one final time for his last trip out there this June, actually this month. So it's a pleasure to have Tom. He's going to be Skyping in from his home in Silver Springs, Maryland, and we're going to get to that podcast and to that interview in just a moment here. But I wanted to, again, just welcome everybody to the podcast, welcome everybody to Chasing Earhart. We're extremely happy to have you aboard. And without further ado, I give you Tom King. Enjoy. So let's start this interview with a question that I'm sure has started every interview you've ever given. However, we're going to make it a two-part question. Can you tell us first a little bit about your education, your background, and how you became an archaeologist?
Well, I got interested in archaeology as a small child and was an amateur archaeologist as a teenager. Grew up and turned pro. After I got back from the Navy, I went to college at San Francisco State University and then eventually at UCLA and UC Riverside. And in those days, what we mostly did was what were called salvage archaeology, where we were rushing around in front of the bulldozers before things were destroyed, digging as fast as we could. And that's basically how I got my start in California archaeology. Eventually wound up through a strange set of circumstances going out to Micronesia and spending two very interesting years on Saipan and in the islands of Micronesia, setting up historic preservation programs. Came back to the United States and worked for the federal government for a while and eventually went into private practice, which is what I do now.
So how did Amelia Earhart come into your life?
Well, I knew of Amelia Earhart. Of course, everybody knows of Amelia Earhart. And I knew a little bit about her because my father had been a naval officer in World War II and was on Saipan and in Chuuk and a bunch of other places in Micronesia. And he came back with stories about Earhart and people saying that she'd been offed by the Japanese and so on. Didn't think much of them, didn't believe much in it. And he was dead by the time I went to Micronesia. I heard Earhart stories there too, but my shtick was setting up historic preservation programs with indigenous Micronesian cultures. So I was not much interested in pursuing extinct American aviators. So it wasn't until I was leaving the federal government in about 1988 that I got a call from Rick Gillespie, the founder, one of the two founders of Tiger. And Rick had this question. He said, okay, we've avoided the Earhart story all this time because there's so many screwy hypotheses about her, but we're going to try to look at it. We've got a new hypothesis that some of our members have brought in that says that she may have wound up on an uninhabited island in the South Pacific. And he said, here's my question for you. She was carrying these first day covers, these commemorative stamp issues, and she was going to sell them when she got around. Now, if we found those first day stamp issues, would it be ethical for us to sell them? Would the archaeological community think that was ethical? And I said, well, Rick, you know, I could answer on this side and I could answer on that side. And yeah, there are a number of different possibilities, but you're not going to find paper products on an airplane in the South Pacific. But I'm leaving government. I don't have a job for a while. If you need somebody, if you need an archaeologist, here I am. And he did. And I went on the first expedition and basically got hooked. And that's what I've been doing as my hobby ever since.
For the people that may not know, can you tell us a little bit about what the difference is between a theory and a hypothesis?
Well, a theory is an organized body of thinking about a subject. A hypothesis is basically an educated guess that can be tested. It is my hypothesis that the car keys that I lost yesterday are on my kitchen table. I can test that hypothesis by going and looking on the kitchen table and seeing if they're there. Of course, hypotheses get a lot more elaborate than that. But basically what we're doing, the various things that are usually called theories about Earhart really are hypotheses. They're educated guesses about what happened to her. And they can be more or less tested through some kind of research activity.
And when does a hypothesis go from being circumstantial to being plausible to being proven?
I don't know that a hypothesis is ever proven. We get more and more and more confident in it, depending on how much information we get and how consistent that information is. And eventually we get to the point where we can say, yeah, we're pretty bloody sure that this is what happened. But I try to avoid thinking of anything as the absolute truth because, hey, lots of things change and we come up with new ideas all the time.
I think a big part of any hypothesis is the data that it contains. So let's talk a little bit about that data in general. From an archaeological standpoint, data is key. And in the case of Amelia Earhart, there's so much data, whether it be historical fact, physical artifacts, or eyewitness testimony. From your point of view, how do you discern the data that is plausible, relevant data from the data that's either irrelevant to your hypothesis or just flat out bad data in general?
Well, I think the basic question is, can it be verified? Can we do something to ascertain whether it's reasonably likely to be correct? So with a lot of the anecdotal accounts, for example, the oral historical accounts, yes, somebody said that they saw somebody who was interpreted as Earhart on Island X, maybe being killed by the Japanese. Okay, how do we verify that? Well, we don't really have a way to verify that. All we can do is trust the person or not trust the person and get more corroborative evidence. If somebody says, I found Amelia Earhart's briefcase with AE on the side and a bunch of papers inside that were definitely hers, and I found it on Island X. Well, if the person left it on Island X, where we can go back and check and find that, yes, indeed, it really is there, and it does have an AE on the side, and it does have the papers inside, okay, then that's good evidence. So it all comes down to verifiability.
You have written countless papers and articles and even some books on the research that you have taken part in with Tiger. So can we start with a brief overview of the Amelia Earhart Tiger hypothesis?
Okay. The Tiger hypothesis is that on the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Earhart and Noonan, her navigator, in their Lockheed Electra 10E, were very close to Howland Island, which was their destination that day. But they couldn't find it. And they couldn't find it probably because they had lost their belly antenna on takeoff from Ley, New Guinea. They couldn't establish communication with the Coast Guard cutter Itasca that was lying off the island. They couldn't find their way in. At that point, Earhart said, and this is the last message that everybody agrees was from her, she said, "We are flying north and south on the line 157-337. Okay, that's a line running from 157 degrees to 337 degrees on the compass. And what that was in navigator talk in those days was a line of position that Noonan would have plotted through Howland Island. Well, he would have plotted it perpendicular to their route when the sun came up and he could take a reading. And he then would have advanced it by dead reckoning until he calculated it, that it should be through the island. Okay. Our hypothesis is that they flew mostly south on that line of position. And that line of position, if plotted through the vicinity of Howland Island, would bring them to Nikumaroro. We think they came up on Nikumaroro around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. The tide was almost dead low. We think they landed on the reef safely, got off the plane, were able to transmit radio messages for several days, and radio messages were received that everybody thought were from Earhart during that period. Then the tide gradually got higher and higher until it floated the airplane off the reef. It busted up along the face of the reef into tiny little pieces, which have been coughed up periodically onto the reef and collected by people. Earhart and Noonan then were stranded, and they eventually died. We think that Noonan probably died first. Earhart died later. We think Earhart probably died at what we call the seventh site at the southeast end of the island. And that's it in a nutshell.
So let's dive in a bit here and break things down. Amelia is flying toward Howland Island on the morning of July the 2nd. However, there are three issues here. She's unable to see the island from the vantage point she's flying at. She's unable to communicate with the Itasca, or at least the communication is broken on her end. And lastly, she's running low on fuel. So there's three questions here, and we'll tackle them one at a time. The first one is altitude. She dropped to approximately 1,000 feet at this point, which made her visibility almost zero for Howland. What do you think was her reasoning for dropping that low?
Well, we think that probably from her perspective, there was a high ceiling, and she wanted to get down under it. Now, it appeared to be a clear day from Howland Island and from the Itasca. From her vantage point, there must have been something about the way that the sunlight was refracting off the cloud surface or something that caused her to get down to 1,000 feet. But that would certainly restrict her visibility. We don't know what caused her to go that low, but apparently she did.
There are a lot of discussions when it comes to radio communication. A lot of folks out there are arguing the radio communication aspect of the last few hours of the flight. When it comes to the radio communication, what do you think went wrong there?
Well, there are several things. She doesn't seem to have established a very, an entirely mutually understood protocol with the Itasca about who would broadcast when on which frequencies. And so there was some confusion there. The big thing, though, is that there's evidence that she lost her belly antenna taking off from New Guinea. And we don't know the whole configuration of her radio setup, but we think that the belly antenna was critical to her communication, to her radio direction finding. And without it, she was pretty much stuck. So probably that's the main factor.
Lastly, we're going to talk about fuel. So everyone seems to have a different opinion on what running low on fuel means. In your eyes, how do you think her fuel levels were at that point?
We don't know how much fuel she had, and all we can do is what any other pilots would do. And I have to say, I'm not a pilot. I'm not an airplane guy. There are a lot of airplane people in Tiger, and they have ideas, and I just basically parrot them because I'm just a dumb archaeologist. But low on fuel can mean a number of things. It can mean, yeah, we're really low on fuel. We're about to run out of fuel. It can mean we're down to the point where we're going to have to switch to our reserve, which is what generally Tiger thinks happened, that she said, yeah, we're getting pretty close to where we're going to have to go into our reserve. And it can probably mean a number of other things. She should have had enough fuel to fly for a couple of hours after arriving in the vicinity of Howland Island if she was managing her fuel the way that she had said she was going to manage it and the way she had been told to manage it and the way that she had planned to manage it. She should have had a couple, three more hours of flying time. Now, the people who think that she didn't have enough fuel and that she went right into the drink generally think that she didn't manage her fuel very efficiently and or she had headwinds that she didn't anticipate, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all those things may be true, but we don't have any evidence for them. And so we sort of take the simple hypothesis that, yeah, she was saying, we're getting low, we're getting to the point where we're going to have to go into our reserve. That's scary. Let's communicate, fellas. And that's what she was talking about.
So they decide to fly southeast along the line of position, and finally they see Gardner Island. Was it an educated guess to fly that way? After not finding Howland, were they shooting for Gardner as a plan B, or was it a shot in the dark that they came across Gardner Island?
Well, it was probably a shot, something of a shot in the dark. We don't really know because we don't know what kind of charts they had aboard the plane. All we know they had was a sort of strip chart along their route. But Noonan had navigated through that area. He knew the general area. So if you generally know where the islands are, you know that if you fly north from Howland Island, if you fly on the 357 line, the next land you get to is the Kamchatka Peninsula. It's 4,000 miles away. You're not going to make it. You know that if you fly south, southeast on the 157 line, there are islands down there. You may not know exactly what the islands are, but you know that there are islands down there. And so it's probably a better decision to fly south. You may fly north for a little bit, not see anything, and then say, okay, we better fly south. And you go south. That's our guess. It's only a guess.
Let's talk about the landing. In your summary of the evidence paper, you state that, quote, they landed safely on the broad, smooth northwest reef flat north of the Norwich City wreckage. At the end of the day, that is a coral reef. Do you think the landing did any initial damage to the Electra?
Well, the reef flat there is very smooth. And we have pilots who say they could put down a 747 on that reef. Did she have any damage in landing there? We don't know. Certainly, it's possible. It's even likely that she dropped one of her gear into a crack, into a hole, something. She could do some damage. Again, we don't really have any way to know.
Over the next several days, Amelia and presumably Fred sent out several radio distress calls. Then comes the high tide that pulls the plane over the reef, into the lagoon, and either presumably out to sea or into the ocean depths. It's been widely argued that the Electra was like a ping pong ball with wings that could float almost indefinitely. Can you talk a little bit about why you believe that it didn't float and that it either sank or was swept out to sea?
Well, it certainly may have floated, and we debate that. It's possible that it floated, it could have floated miles. But the other side of it being like a ping pong ball is it's very fragile. An airplane, an aluminum airplane, is a very fragile piece of construction. And the surf on the edge of the Nicomororo Reef is fierce. It's a very, very high energy environment. And particularly if something gets hung up, I mean, suppose it goes over the edge of the reef and then it gets hung up. There are a lot of little cracks in the edge of the reef. Gets hung up there, it's beaten back and forth by the waves, it's going to get torn to pieces very, very quickly. And it's not going to float. It's going to go down, or it's going to be broken up and scattered along the face of the reef. Now, again, it may have floated. That's a possibility. But personally, knowing the reef as well as I do, and I've seen that reef in a lot of different conditions, my guess is that it wouldn't survive long on the reef edge.
The search at the time was the largest of its kind, ordered by FDR. However, it's been said that the air portion of the search were mostly flybys that were too high to get a visual on anyone that may be attempting to signal them from below. Why do you think there were no ground crews deployed on the surrounding islands to search for Amelia and Fred?
Good question. And we don't really have an answer to that. We know that the crew of the Colorado, the USS Colorado that steamed into the area, was not real happy to be doing the search. These were uncharted waters. You got to remember that in those days, we didn't have good charts. In fact, Nicomororo was mislocated by a considerable distance. And the maps of it were utterly inaccurate. So you got a great big expensive battleship that you're maneuvering into these uncharted seas. You're going to be real careful. There's also some evidence that they thought that Nicomororo was inhabited, that there were people living on it. And if that was the case, well, gee, those people should have seen Earhart if she landed. And so they said they saw evidence of recent habitation. If they thought that that was evidence of people who were living there ordinarily, there's no reason for them to land. There people are down there. They haven't seen Earhart. There was no place very good to land. You put a float plane down in the lagoon. The lagoon is full of coral heads. You're likely to run into one of them. You're going to sink your airplane. That's going to be a mess. So there probably was not a whole lot of impetus to go ashore unless you had a real good reason to do so. Now, they did go ashore. They did land at Monra, then Sydney Island, and talked with the guy who was planting coconuts there. But that was the only place that they landed. They did, and they didn't spend much time in the air over any of the islands. They went over, they waggled their wings, nobody came out of the bush waving a hanky, and away they flew.
So, presumably after they lose the Electra for good, Amelia and maybe Fred set out to walk the island. At this point, I'm guessing they're in survival mode, as now their plane is gone, and they don't know if their distress calls have been heard. They take what little equipment they have, Amelia's cosmetics and compact with Mirror, and they head out. Obviously, the first bet, I would think, is to find a water source of some kind. Can you talk about what they would have effectively needed to do in order to survive as long as possible and hold out for potential rescue?
Well, water's the biggie. Food is not a problem. Food is easy to get on Nicomororo. But water is the big problem. Now, at the southeast end of the island, there are two ponds of water. And from the air, you can't tell whether those are salt water or fresh water. In fact, they are very salty salt water. But I would be very surprised if Earhart didn't circle the island before landing. If she did, she would have seen the ponds. And a natural thing to do would be to go check and see if those ponds are fresh water. So my suspicion is that that may be the thing that took them south. But in any event, you're going to want to explore your island and find out what you've got to deal with. And you're particularly going to be looking for water.
Fred Noonan gets kind of lost in all of this. There is some suggestion that he had a head injury as a result of the landing. What do you think the probability is that he never made it off the plane?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you'd calculate a probability like that. The evidence that he was injured is basically radio messages in which Earhart or someone said, "My navigator is injured," or made some indication that Fred had an injury. Okay, that doesn't imply that he's sitting in the airplane waiting to go over the edge of the reef. To me, that implies, okay, we've gotten ashore, but he's hurt. I mean, one thing you got to remember is that it's about 110 degrees Fahrenheit on that reef. And you're in an aluminum airplane. You're not going to stay there if you don't have to. You're going to get out of that thing and get ashore where you got some wind, where you got some breeze, where you got some fresh air. So did Fred remain on the plane? It's possible, but I think it's unlikely. Now, I've written a novel trying to interpret what likely happened, and I assume that Fred got ashore and lasted for several days, but then died of his head injuries. That is pure speculation on my part, but it's consistent with the evidence that we have.
If Amelia was, in fact, alone, what kind of effect would it have had on her morale if Fred was with her on the island? If he did make it off the plane with Amelia and perish sometime afterward, what kind of effect would that have had on her mindset, knowing that she's all alone and she doesn't know if her distress calls have been heard?
I should think it would put a lot of stress. It would be presumably better if Fred survived, and her morale would be better if there were two of them wandering around looking for stuff than if there was only one. On the other hand, if she had to care for him and he's injured, maybe he's out of his mind, that would make things worse. Assuming he then dies and she's left all alone, I should think that that would be pretty challenging. Again, in my novel, I assume that it's very challenging, and she reacts to it, in the way that any normal person would. She's very distressed and feels guilty and feels like she ought to take responsibility for his death, and, you know, on and on and on. But that's all speculation, and that's all we can do.
Let's get into the Seven Site. According to Tiger Research, this was an ideal place for Amelia to stake camp for many reasons, and we'll kind of go through them one by one. There's access to a forest area. It's maybe the coolest part of the island due to breezes coming in from the east. There's access to the shore and the lagoon. There's climbable trees that could be lookouts for potential rescue by sea. And there's also a plethora of food, turtles, fish, clams, birds, etc. And there's lastly potential firewood if they could somehow extract it. It's kind of a no-brainer, but you've been there several times. Even now, if someone was stranded, would this be the most ideal spot on the island to stake a claim and hold out for rescue?
I don't know that it would be the most ideal spot. It would be a good spot. It's got the Seventh Site is basically on a surge ridge, a ridge of coral rubble that's been built up by storm surges over the years. So it's relatively high. Now, relatively high in Nika Moreau terms is not very high. It's like, you know, 5 meters off sea level. But it's facing into the trade wind. So you've got a nice breeze most of the time. It's relatively comfortable. You do have good trees to climb. They probably had good trees to climb anywhere on Nika Moreau at that point. It's a place where you can see the sea, where you can access the reef flat, which is all full of tide pools, full of fish, and so on. It's a place where you can access the lagoon easily, which also has lots of resources. So it would be a good place. I think I think it would be a very good place. Whether it would be absolutely the ideal place, I don't know.
You guys have found a lot of data here, and we'll run through some of it. You found parts of a woman's shoe, parts of a man's shoe, a sextant box that may or may not have been Navy surplus, pieces of a woman's compact and fragments of rouge, a zipper, a snap, a button, and parts of a pocket knife. For Tiger, this site's a gold mine. What does finding a site like this with all this material do for the morale of the team, and what does it do for the team's hypothesis?
Well, first, you got to understand that we think there were bones found on the island in 1940, and we have documentary evidence of the discovery of those bones, which then were lost. And from the descriptions of where the bones were found, and from aerial photographic evidence from the same period, we're pretty sure that the seventh site is where the bones were found. So when we found a lot of fire, the remains of campfires and bird and fish and turtle bones and artifacts there that are indicative of somebody living there in the 1930s or 40s, it's pretty exciting. And going after the seventh site, having the seventh site to work with, certainly does wonders for morale, if you will.
Tiger has found many artifacts and pieces of evidence that many people would agree is circumstantial. I think when you can create a body of evidence like the one that's been created, it holds a lot more merit than, say, one or two pieces might hold. However, everyone wants that one piece of indisputable evidence, the smoking gun. You have stated that historical and archaeological research rarely provide smoking gun proofs. Do you think that once a large body of evidence like this is collected, that it can hold the same merit as a single piece of smoking gun evidence?
Well, okay. Our critics say, well, there are lots of other sources for these different kinds of artifacts and so on. And there are. The colonists who were there from 1939 to 1963 could have brought stuff to the site. The Coast Guardsmen who were there from 1944 to 46 could have brought stuff. We know they brought stuff. We have clear evidence that they brought stuff to the site. So there are alternative ways to create this body of evidence. But it gets down to the question of what's the most efficient way to account for the evidence. And we think that the most efficient way to account for the evidence is through Earhart having been there. Now, can we ever say on the basis of circumstantial evidence that that is an absolute fact? No. We can only say that this is where the evidence points. This is what it suggests.
If the case of Amelia Earhart on Gardner Island is a court of law case, and Tiger is the prosecution, have you proven your case beyond a reasonable doubt?
Ask the judge. I don't know. If I'm the attorney, I am hoping that the judge finds for me, but I can't be absolutely sure for the jury.
If you use the case you built as evidence and you put it up against what would have to be the alternative, the case is pretty strong. That's how a court of law works. If you never find the smoking gun that everyone is clamoring for, are you personally happy with the case that Tiger has built?
If it ended today, if the island sank into the sea tomorrow, which it could do, if we all died or whatever, I would still think that we've got a very good body of evidence pointing to Amelia and Fred having wound up on Nicomororo. Have we absolutely proved it? No. But I think we've made a very good case for it, and it is, I think, a better case than those that are based solely on circumstantial, on anecdotal evidence, like the Saipan hypothesis. So, would I be happy? No, I want to go back and take another shot at the island, but would I be satisfied? Well, I'd have to be.
Here's another question that's probably been asked of you several times. What is it about this case that fascinates the world so much? People go missing all the time. Why is Amelia Earhart still holding the world's attention 80 years later?
Oh, good question. She was a fascinating woman, an inspiring person. She has continued to inspire people all through the decades. And she went missing under circumstances that everybody thought were very mysterious, and that sort of enhanced her mystique, if you will. So you've got this beautiful, exciting, interesting, inspirational woman who vanishes into thin air, and nobody can find her. And the greatest air sea search in recorded history can't locate her. Oh, wow, something strange happened to her. Okay, even if she had not disappeared under mysterious circumstances, she was an inspirational enough person that she was a role model for lots and lots of people. And so people continue to be very understandably attracted to her and attracted to her story, and therefore wonder what happened to her. I guess. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not in a position to interpret these things, but that's my assumption.
Tiger's going out again this summer. Can you tell us a little bit about that expedition, what we can expect, and what you are expecting to do with that expedition?
Well, just that we will be going back in June of this year, and we still have some cabins available on the ship if anybody wants to sign on. We'll be taking people, not just experienced Tiger team members, but regular old people, because the more eyes we put on the island, the more likely we are to see something. And we'll be doing a number of organized research activities in pursuit of very specific research questions. And maybe we'll come up with a smoking gun, or maybe we'll come up with a little bit of smoking ammunition, or maybe we won't. But it's going to be my last shot at the island. I'm getting too old to jump in and out of little boats on coral reefs. And I'm hoping that it will be a good trip for everybody concerned, and that maybe we'll come back with something real.
If Amelia were alive today, what do you think she would think about all this?
I think she would probably think that it's very silly, and that it's a waste of time and effort, and that people ought to get on with their lives. But that's only my guess.
Tom, it's been a pleasure having you on the Chasing Her Heart podcast. Thank you so much for being here. You have a great day.
My pleasure. You do the same.
So there you have it. That was Tom King with Tiger. We're very appreciative of Tom to be our first guest on the Chasing Her Heart podcast. Now, it's really important to note that we're going to be having these episodes released bi-weekly. So we're going to get to everyone. It's going to take some time, but everybody's going to have their say, and everybody's going to have an equal opportunity to present their information, their data, their analysis, in the same way that you just heard Mr. King present his analysis. Now, this is episode one. We're very happy that you have joined us with Chasing Your Heart and you've come aboard this podcast. For iTunes listeners, please subscribe to iTunes. Google Play, same thing. Please subscribe to our podcast on Google Play and on iTunes. Our website is a great place to hear the podcast and to stream them as well. If you don't have the ability to do that on a smartphone or on an app, you can always go to our website and you can go ahead and stream it that way. So we have multiple platforms and multiple ways for you to actually hear this podcast. If you have any suggestions for who we should have on the podcast, a future guest or someone that we should maybe interview and talk to, please feel free to contact us at our website. You can see our contact form on our website. You could drop us a line there. You could drop us a line in the comments here. However you want to do it, just reach out to us. We're very accessible. If you want to make any comments or suggestions about the quality of the podcast, anything like that, please feel free to do so. Again, my name is Chris Williamson. It's been a pleasure hosting the inaugural episode of Chasing Earhart. We have so much more to come, so much more information to get out there. We have some really great shows lined up, and we're very excited to bring them to you. Thanks again for being here, and we'll see you next time.